Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour coming at you from KBOO Portland. That music you're listening to is a song called What Have They Done by Squeeze, about the predations of industrial capitalism. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the next hour. Today on our show, Jan Hawkins speaks with anthropologist Hugh Gusterson about the film Oppenheimer, Who the Man Really Was, and the role of domestic communists in both birthing and opposing the bomb. After that, book mole Larry Bolden reviews a novel by Helen Elaine Lee about one black woman's experience with the carceral state. To close our show, we bring you a brief talk from radical scholar Nick Estes of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, who lays out the geopolitics of indigenous resistance to extractive and colonial capitalism. Before we get rolling, let me remind you that KBOO is volunteer-powered and listener-supported community radio. We survive because of generous donors like you. If you can contribute, please go to kboo.fm/give or simply text KBOO to 44321. And thanks to everyone out there who has given so generously in the past. 77 years ago this month, the U.S. dropped two atomic bombs on Japan. The actual death toll will never be known, but estimates range up to more than 200,000 people. Christopher Nolan's new film, Oppenheimer, explores the rise and fall of Robert Oppenheimer, the so-called father of the atomic bomb. How accurate is Nolan's portrayal of the man and his times? Jan Hawkins speaks with Hugh Gusterson, a professor of anthropology at University of British Columbia, who has written extensively about nuclear weapons, the culture of nuclear weapons laboratories, and international security.
Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning, Hugh Gusterson.
It's a pleasure to be here, Janice.
Well, as an academic anthropologist, you've carried out research for years on militarism, securitization, and nuclear policy. And you're the author of a number of books on atomic weapons and the nuclear laboratories, including Nuclear Rights and People of the Bomb. I first learned about your work some time back when you gave a lecture based on your studies as an anthropologist of government nuclear laboratories. So it's delightful to have you on the show today to talk about Christopher Nolan's new film, Oppenheimer. Nolan's biopic traces the rise of this American theoretical physicist, Robert Oppenheimer, as he rose during the Second World War to direct Los Alamos and the lab there in the direction of the Manhattan Project, and his tragic decline during the McCarthy era. So Hugh, in your research and writing, you've disagreed with many of the liberal or left critiques of scientists who worked in these government laboratories. Let's start with your general take on the film and then talk about some of the specific issues that have been raised by critics and those who love the film as well.
So my general take on the film, it's a very accurate portrayal of the Manhattan Project and of Oppenheimer from everything I know about the Manhattan Project. I'm astonished that it's been as successful as it's been. 3 hours is a long time to sit without a break through a film. It's a very complicated film. It keeps jumping backwards and forwards in time. It has an astonishing array of characters, some of whom don't appear for very long. So I'm astonished, actually, that it's been as successful as it has. And I think it has to partly speak to a simmering disquiet that people have about the continued existence of nuclear weapons. I mean, I do remember this moment in the early 1980s when a number of movies came out, like The Day After and Threads and films like that, that spoke to a moment of immense anxiety about an arms race that was obviously out of control in the early 1980s when arms control negotiations between the US and Russia had broken down and all sorts of new weapons were being deployed. And I'm wondering if we're in a similar moment. We don't have a complete runaway arms race, but we have Putin threatening to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. We have North Korea expanding its nuclear arsenal. There seems to be nothing we can do about that. India and Pakistan are engaged in a nuclear arms race. And the US is spending more on nuclear weapons R&D today than it did during the Cold War, an astonishing fact.
As well as the efforts to revive the nuclear power industry, another part of that history and its story that's not really taken up in the film. Well, do you think in terms of the narrative structure of this story and the anxieties attached to it when you revisit the history of the development of the atomic bomb, that focusing on a singular genius and his charisma and his rise and fall, denouement of the film, is limiting in a certain way. Of course, films depend on characters to drive the story, but you've worked quite a bit and carried out research as an anthropologist on the culture of these laboratories. Do you think there's anything lost or importantly obscured by focusing so much on the singular figure of Oppenheimer as the so-called father of the bomb, the most important man in history? You know, these kinds of statements are in the film itself.
You know, in terms of the way Hollywood sells tickets and draws people into movies, a dramatization of an anthropological study of lab culture would not turn back the money that was spent on making the film, right?
I don't know. I'd like to give it a try. Let's revisit that later.
So I think that a great Hollywood film director, and there's no doubt that Christopher Nolan is a great director, a very gifted director, and the depiction of Oppenheimer is an extraordinary piece of acting in the film. You know, there's no doubt that I think that was the only way that they could do this. And Oppenheimer is a fascinating character. I mean, he, more than any human being, made nuclear weapons exist. Much of the commentary I've read since has asked the very interesting question of whether nuclear weapons would ever have been brought into existence had it not been for the fear that Hitler was going to get them, and then for Oppenheimer's single-minded determination to keep going, even when it was clear that the Nazis were not going to get the weapons.
His genius was not as a theoretical physicist primarily, but in some of his organizational skills. Is that correct?
Well, both. And from everything I hear, he had an extremely holistic intelligence. He had an ability to hold the organizational details of a laboratory in his mind and resolve them with one another at the same time. And he had an extraordinarily holistic intelligence capable of understanding the different aspects of the bomb design problem. This may amuse you or not, but a female nuclear weapons designer at Los Alamos once told me that women are much better at nuclear weapons design than men are because they think holistically. And that the way a nuclear weapon behaves when it explodes, you have so many things interacting with each other and changing the parameters of the event as it unfolds, that you have to have someone with an extraordinarily holistic intelligence to put all of that together. And there's no doubt that Oppenheimer had that.
You know, taking that idea of holistic thinking from gender differences into the left-wing politics, I think some of his complexity and moral torments were rooted in his left-wing sympathies that then were part of how we come to care about him and trust him with some moral compass. and his conflict around the horrors of this technology that he helped to give birth to, but then his fall during the McCarthy era. How do you see the arc of the morality tale in this film, particularly as I think it granted him quite a bit with his early communist sympathies, his leanings towards socialism, and then that as central to his tragic fall during the fever of the McCarthy era after the war?
I think part of the reason so much has been written about Oppenheimer is not just what he achieved, it's his Sphinx-like personality. I mean, I imagine that you could have 10 people come and watch this film with you, and you would have 10 interpretations of Oppenheimer at the end of it, right? There's an interpretation that he was arrogant. There's an interpretation that he was naive. Many people insist to this day that he was a Soviet spy. Most people insist that he wasn't. But still, people find evidence for both interpretations.
And I, right? My interpretation as a clinical psychologist was this guy was on the verge of a nervous breakdown all along. I thought it was interesting how he had a psychiatric hospitalization early in his adulthood and kind of fell apart during this aggressive interrogation during the McCarthy era. And that the question, why didn't he stand up for himself? Why was he so weak in standing up to this?
Well, so Kitty, his wife, asks him at one point, halfway through his security clearance hearing, she says, why aren't you fighting? And so as a psychologist, what's your interpretation of that? I mean, at the very end of the film, she gives an interpretation, which is that he felt so guilty about what he'd done that he thought he deserved to be punished. And he was sort of collaborating with his own disgrace.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what you think.
Well, I think there might have been an element of moral masochism, is the term often used. And I think people who've struggled with hard problems throughout history can kind of fit that profile of submitting. You know, one person's moral courage is another person's moral masochism. And I think that he didn't do it very effectively. It was, I think, partly a product of a situation. He had tremendous support, including from the military, during his rise. And I think there's maybe a part of him that could not believe that this was happening around him. And I think that often happens where people who've had developed a certain trust, including many of the people who are victims of McCarthyism, had risen to tremendous power and stature, and then are suddenly abandoned by the government that has relied on them and are persecuted by that same government. And I think we're seeing elements of that now, what people call neo-McCarthyism, where academics who've come into programs around racial and gender justice initiatives are attacked as being un-American. And it's very unsettling. And so I can see just situationally how he could fall apart under those conditions.
I think we're back to him being simultaneously very arrogant and very naive. I mean, he's
vulnerable. Because
of what he'd done, he was immune. But he didn't see all the ways he was being used by the military. There's a scene in the film where Groves promises that Truman will tell Stalin about the bomb at the Potsdam.
Now, do you want to say who Groves was as a character?
General Groves was the general who built the Pentagon and then was put in charge of the Los Alamos lab and the Manhattan Project, and he picked Oppenheimer to direct the project. So he makes Groves promise that Truman will discuss the bomb with Stalin before it's dropped, and Truman doesn't, really. And Oppenheimer realizes that he's been naive, that he doesn't have the pull that he thinks he has. In terms of your original question about why focus it on one person and is this person of interest, I try to imagine if Oppenheimer had the personality of Groves and if he'd been purely loyal And he'd just done this amazing scientific feat. He pulled together these scientists. He never had any doubts about it. He glorified in what he'd done. And then as he saw it, ending the war soon by having the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, it wouldn't be half the film that it is, right? What makes it such an extraordinarily powerful film is this constant doubleness of Oppenheimer that leaves you perpetually perplexed about who he is. He's a man who's always having extramarital affairs, but a man of great integrity in other regards. You know, who is this man?
I think also the arc of the film as an American morality tale also raises the repressed history of U.S. scientists and our collective ties and indebtedness to communists in this country, who were major force in the 1930s around then the labor movement, in so many areas of the society fighting for social justice. And you see this early on, his interest in social justice, and that drew him to the Communist Party and communist fellow travelers. And then during the McCarthy era, how this turns into an attack on him. And I think the film itself partly keeps in focus that issue of what is our relationship to the history of American communism and the contributions of American communists. And how does that figure into conceptions of loyalty? What's your take on that arc of the film as an American morality tale?
Well, there are very few films I can think of that portray American communists sympathetically. And a lot of the scientists in this film are communists or have communist sympathies, they're fellow travelers, if you like. Most of them turn out to be loyal Americans. Oppenheimer himself, when Hakon Chevalier in one scene tries to recruit him to spy for the Soviets, Oppenheimer says to him, that would be treason. And he refuses to go along with it. As far as I can tell, he's a loyal American. So the film is interesting partly because there's this sort of side story where it is portraying these communists quite sympathetically. To me, the film really raised the question of how you judge the patriotism and loyalty of people you're giving access to classified information. All of the people who spied for the Soviets on the Manhattan Project were communists. There's no doubt that the military was right to be worried about communists working on this project. On the other hand, the vast majority of the communists who worked on it did not spy. The film mentions Klaus Fuchs, who was brought into the project by the British, and he spied for the communists. He gave the Soviets an actual design of the Nagasaki weapon. One thing we don't learn from the film about Klaus Fuchs that I think is very interesting, he was a refugee from Nazi Germany who settled in England, and the English immediately interned him. He was interned in Britain, and then he was interned in Canada. So did he spy for the Soviets because he was a communist? Or did he spy for the Soviets because the country he'd tried to become a citizen of interned him? It's a very interesting question in my mind that the film doesn't address. It does show that there was a communist threat. If you follow the story in later years, before this conversation, out of curiosity, I went and looked it up and made a list of all the people who spied for the Soviets, who've been caught spying for the Soviets from the 1980s onwards. They all did it for money. None of them were communists. John Anderson Walker, Ronald Pelton, Aldrich Ames, Robert Hansen, Charles McGonagall, the CIA agents, NSA agents, FBI agents. They all did it for money. One of them, John Walker, was a John Bircher, but he spied for the Soviets. So there are all sorts of reasons why people can be disloyal. If someone is right-wing, you don't automatically suspect them. In fact, you trust them, but you shouldn't have trusted John Walker, right? So how do you determine whether someone's going to be loyal? It's a puzzle.
This is Jan Hawken talking today with Hugh Gusterson about the film Oppenheimer.
That musical clip was from a song called Enola Gay by Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. Enola Gay was the name of the airplane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. We now return to Jan Håkan speaking with Hugh Gustafson.
Another arc in the film, kind of moral turning point, is where the bomb clearly is intended to be dropped on Japan rather than on Nazi Germany. And Oppenheimer himself evidences conflict and resistance to that, although he does end up following through and participating in the plan to drop those two nuclear weapons.
He doesn't just participate. He sits on the very small committee that picks Hiroshima and Nagasaki as targets.
So there is the tendency to redeem people if they've suffered a moment of conscience. You know, there's a kind of redemption or forgiveness if you've suffered, but go ahead and do it anyway. So there's that potential trap there. But how do you see the film's casting of the shift from Nazi Germany as a target to Japan? Because some scientists did oppose, who had worked on the the weapons project, dropping the bombs on Japan. And that isn't, as I recall, part of the story.
So there is one scientist who's not mentioned in the film who actually left Los Alamos as soon as the Nazis surrendered. He said, I signed up to stop the Nazis from getting to a bomb first. I'm out of here. There's only one, Joseph Rotblat, who went on to found the International Pugwash Association of Scientists Trying to Avert a Nuclear Arms Race. My interpretation of why they kept going largely relies on a different film, the wonderful documentary film, The Day After Trinity, made by John Elsey. And he interviews a number of the Manhattan Project scientists for that film and asks them, why did you keep going? And you see them look bemused by the question almost. And they say, well, you know, we were working like 12, 14-hour days. We'd become so obsessed with solving the technical problem. It was just like momentum. It had become about itself at that point. We just couldn't stop. We were almost there. And for most of us, it never occurred to us to stop because we were completely absorbed in solving this problem. And if I can sort of segue to my own studies of a nuclear weapons lab at Lawrence Livermore in the 1980s, I don't want to say that the scientists never thought about the ethics of what they did, because they did. When I asked them whether they thought about the ethics of their work, they said, almost all of them would say the same thing. They would say, you're so lucky you're talking to me because I really think about it, but my colleagues don't. So it was clear that they were thinking about it, but just not talking about it collectively. But when I got to know them, there's this sort of tunnel vision when a technical problem, a fascinating technical problem, takes over. And so the
scientists has a lot of government money behind it.
Yeah. So the scientists, I think, got sucked into that tunnel vision. And I think it's striking to me that the petition to do a demonstration of the bomb and not to drop it on a Japanese city without warning did not come from the Los Alamos lab in New Mexico, which was almost like a cult at this point. It was totally cut off from the outside world. You couldn't leave and talk to people outside. It had just become about itself. That petition to do a demonstration came from an adjunct of the Manhattan Project in Chicago, where people were not quite as inducted into the cult. They had the benefit of other points of view of a normal social life, right? They weren't totally cut off from the world.
Well, I'd like to also talk about a part of the story of the history of these nuclear labs that goes beyond the film's own denouement, where you have the fall of Oppenheimer himself during the McCarthy era. But of course, these labs continue, and they continue for some time making nuclear bombs and also the nuclear material used in what Eisenhower called Atoms for Peace, you know, converting this industry that's associated with horror and destruction into kind of rebranding it as the power of the future. How do you see the ongoing life of these labs? I mean, that's a big topic, but is there anything critical that is left out by this closure? Because that's part of what stories do and films do, is they offer closure. But then, and of course, you have to stop at some point. It was a very all 3 hours. But I think we can still use a film to keep open, to open the film's own closure to questions that haunt us to this day, both around nuclear weapons and nuclear energy.
Wow, where do I begin? So I think there are, if you like, three key turning points in the subsequent history. And many of them happen after the film ends. But the first that the film could have done more with, Oppenheimer actually starts publicly advocating immediately after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He publicly advocates putting nuclear technology under UN international control. What that meant to him under the Acheson-Lilienthal plan, which he largely wrote, was that uranium mining, processing, the production of nuclear material would all have been done by international bodies, that no national government would on its own have had access to that material. It would have prevented the Cold War arms race. The Russians would never have got nuclear weapons. Now, for that reason, it's thought by many historians that the Russians would never have gone along with this.
And also hydrogen bombs.
They would not have happened. So that's the first turning point. Oppenheimer loses the struggle to put the technology under international control. Not only that, but Teller and Lawrence, who are his antagonists in the film, go off and found a second nuclear weapons lab at Livermore in California, because they think Los Alamos is slow walking the hydrogen bomb. And as many people at Livermore told me, when they heard I was going to Los Alamos, they said, oh, you're going to Los Alamos. You should know that the Soviets are the competition, but Los Alamos is the enemy. And so there's a very real sense in which the arms race is between Livermore and Los Alamos. They're constantly competing with each other to outstrip one another. So that's the first turning point, where Teller and Lawrence's vision of what we do is victorious. They get a second weapons lab and a massive escalation of the arms race and the construction of hydrogen bombs. The second turning point comes in 1963. Shortly after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev realize they've almost blown up the planet. And they say, this is crazy. What are we going to do? And they discuss banning all nuclear tests. I cannot tell you how different our world would be today if there had never been a nuclear test since 1963. All the weapons designs that would not have been perfected. So the Russians refused to allow the on-site inspections that would have allowed a complete nuclear test ban treaty in 63. And so instead you had a limited treaty where underground tests continued to be allowed. And so the arms race continued, and the labs were quite comfortable with allowing underground tests. It didn't really stop business as usual for them.
And there's the ongoing health impacts that have been suffered, particularly by indigenous communities, the Navajo and other tribes in Southwest.
Well, once the tests go underground, you don't have that ongoing environmental effect from the contamination of above ground nuclear.
Like you did with the Trinity test.
Yeah. There's a third moment in the Carter administration when he comes close to negotiating a complete test ban treaty with the Soviets, and the director of Los Alamos has a private meeting with Jimmy Carter and talks him out of it. And so nuclear testing continued until it was ended by Bill Clinton. So the last U.S. nuclear test was in 92. The U.S. signed, and the Soviets signed, or the Russians signed, a test ban treaty in 1996, banning all nuclear tests. However, as the price for going along with that, the weapons labs insisted on more funding to maintain the stockpile than they had had during the Cold War. So the weapons labs now employ more people than they did for most of the Cold War. They have an elaborate program to stimulate nuclear testing instead of doing outright nuclear testing, which was their price for going along with the test ban treaty. So there have been actually four key moments where the arms race could have been ended, and it wasn't.
And I think another part of that story that I've tried to focus on in a recent film of my own on the history of nuclear powers, the role of activists, anti-nuclear activists, and activists who were fighting to not only make nuclear power safer and eliminate it, but also the ban the bomb movement that was a real important force. And I think some are hoping to revive the ban the bomb movement, which is part of that history as well.
Well, there is a treaty, the Treaty for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPPNW, that's been signed at this point by 85 different countries. None of the nuclear weapons states have signed it, and they try and pretend it doesn't exist. But there is now a global instrument that would ban nuclear weapons by treaty. And I think we live in a moment where, because of climate change and species extinction, the end of life as we know it is very much on people's minds. And I can imagine a revived movement against nuclear weapons that gets folded into that awareness. And this film may help provoke such a movement, one could hope.
So the film is very much worth seeing, if perhaps as most importantly for reviving public discussions on the legacies of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy that continue to pose threats to our collective survival today. Well, thanks so much, Hugh Gusterson.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, being with us today to talk about the film Oppenheimer and sharing your insights. I hope to have you on again. Maybe we'll watch that film you mentioned. What was the name of it?
The Day After Trinity.
Yeah, so maybe we'll revisit some of this terrain.
And if your listeners are interested in another interesting film that came out last year, the documentary A Compassionate Spy is a documentary about Ted Hall, who miraculously was not prosecuted, although it was known that he spied for the Soviets. He was left alone by the U.S. national security state. And in the film, you see footage of him explaining why he felt it was his moral obligation to give the secret of the bomb to the Soviets. Makes for an interesting viewing.
Okay. Well, Hugh, we're going to have a little mini nuclear festival here on the radio and talk about them. I look forward to having you on again.
That was a little more from the song Enola Gay. Before that, you heard Jan Hawkins speaking with anthropologist Hugh Gusterson about the just-released film Oppenheimer. You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'd like to turn now to Larry Bolden's review of a new novel by African-American writer Helen Elaine Lee called Pomegranate. Lee has written a courageous book about one Black woman's multifaceted struggle to play the hand dealt to her by racial capitalism. As always, I will be reading Larry's review for him. We are told not to judge a book by its cover, but I invite you to judge this book by its delicious image of the pomegranate, the content as rich and colorful as its cover. Pomegranate by Helen Elaine Lee is deeply insightful, sad, and transformative. The book begins and ends with the same refrain, quote, "I live my life forward and backward. Seems like my body remembers what I can't afford to forget. Here I am, alive and awake, still going forward and backward, and brave enough to tell about it," end quote. Renita Atwater is finishing up a four-year term at Oak Hills Correctional Center, about to be set free and determined to win back the parental rights that have been stripped from her. Quote, I stand up like I'm told, and as I approach the gates, the CO who's opening them up gives me a last bit of scorn. Hasta luego. See you back here soon. I throw some shade his way and walk through, and here it is, what I've been wanting and fearing, freedom. End quote. The novel goes forward and backward, forward to her struggle to remain clean and sober, to convince the courts that she is fit to visit her two children, and eventually, perhaps, even to win back the right to raise them. And backwards to the 4 years of imprisonment and the events that led up to it. Without looking for it and surprised at finding it, Renita, or Nita, finds her first real love in prison. Maxine, politically astute and living through the lens of politics 24/7, is the first person to love Nita for who she is and not simply for what she can give. The few visits she gets from her kids and her daddy are both treasured and feared. Quote, Jesus, struggling to get my balance in this present-past jumble. I'm just praying not everything my kids remember is bad. Reaching for the safety of low expectations, I own that nothing good will come of this. They'll look right through me. I'll say something stupid, something wrong. I'll find nothing at all to say. End quote. Amara, 13, and Theo are nearly as anxious on these visits and in the early home visits, once Renita is free, as Renita is. Quote, they listened for their names, visualized their people coming through the trap, bargained with their higher powers. Today, God willing, they would get a visit. If they heard their names, they answered with relief and often tears. If they didn't, there was another absence to add to all the others as they receded further and further from the free world. End quote. Renita is lucky in some ways. She had a father who loved her and stood by her until he died during her last years of imprisonment. She had two aunties who had taken in her children and were now charged with determining if Renita was fit even to see her children, let alone live with them. And her mandated psychotherapist, with immense power in the process of determining her fitness to parent, turns out to be a good man and one who understands her on many levels, including her addictions. Renita learns to see the world politically via her friend cum lover, Maxine, who urges Renita not to frequent the prison canteen, spending her pitiful earnings on sweets. Quote, everyone had to find a way to do their time, and the lens of politics was part of Maxine's. She had no choice but seeing and speaking what she saw. Seriously, Renita, Maxine said, think about all the products we make inside. Electronic cables and t-shirts, mattresses and flags, American flags, if you can believe the grotesque irony of that. Locked up all the black folks. And then make us produce flags for the country that's been demeaning and exploiting us since they captured and enslaved us, after they've kept us from voting and owning anything, trapped us in city food deserts and next to toxic waste with schools and jobs and food and places to live, no access, no exit, policing every breath we take, feeding us menthol cigarettes and drugs and blocking us from health care and pitted us against each other and against the folks who should be allies, hoping we'll kill each other off. End quote. Author Helen Elaine Lee attended Harvard Law School and has been associated with dozens of prison groups and prison creative writing programs. She writes with such heart and such clarity of vision. Quote, my dad, he's spirit now, gone and not gone, and that pomegranate he gifted me with, it's got a whole other meaning. I try and see myself as filled with ruby seeds. Everything I've lived, the things I've been and done, what's done to me and for me, that's all of it. It's in me. End quote. I have been talking about Helen Elaine Lee's 2023 novel, Pomegranate. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is Patricia Kullberg reading today for Larry. What do sanctions against Venezuela have to do with the Dakota Access Pipeline? In this 2022 talk for the Portland chapter of DSA, Dr. Nick Estes, citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, lays out the geopolitical context of land-based indigenous challenges to the fossil fuel industry. He makes the case not only for resistance to racial capitalism as the driving force behind fossil fuels, but also to colonial extractive capitalism that continues with the mining of lithium and copper for more sustainable technologies. Estes is the co-founder of Red Nation, an organization dedicated to the liberation of Native people from capitalism and colonialism. He is also assistant professor of American Indian Studies at University of Minnesota. He's the author of Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance, and another book called Standing with Standing Rock, Voices of the No Dapple Movement, which was co-edited with Jaskiran Dillon. Here's Nick Estes in his remarks for the Portland DSA.
I just wanted to give a brief overview of some of the work that we do in the Red Nation and some of the work that we do both at a quote-unquote national but also international scale, and why it's important to have organizations like the DSA as allies in this particular struggle. There are lessons to be learned from Standing Rock, and I think a lot of you have familiarity with that particular struggle, but I think it's important to put it into both a national context in terms of the indigenous movement, where it's at, where it's going, as well as an international context, and how we're seeing many of the same kind of policies that we were fighting in the Obama era, now under the Biden era. I think it's important to kind of see a continuity between Obama, Trump, and Biden versus saying Biden is a kind of departure from the Trump administration. So first of all, I just want to say that the water protector movement, as many of you know, isn't just an exclusively indigenous movement. It's definitely led by indigenous people. And it's not to say that the era of the water protector inaugurated water protectors as we know it today, or created them, or it's where it began. But nonetheless, there was something special that happened at Standing Rock. You know, as indigenous people, of course, you know, we were water protectors prior to colonialism and have been since time immemorial. But there is something unique that happened at Standing Rock that is worthy of attention. And I think it's important to put into context the Obama presidency and its alliance with the fossil fuel industry specifically, that led to that particular struggle, and how we understood it as the Ocheti Shakoni and as indigenous people, but also I think something that gets ignored as anti-imperialists. And so I'll begin with the third point, because that might not be a point that is really kind of shared publicly or mainstreamed in a way that we talk about it in our home community. So first of all, it was under the Obama administration where we saw the rapid increase in domestic oil production, 88% to be exact, from the time he came into office to the time he left. And most of that was directed towards fracking. And we can kind of see this playing out now with the drums of war being beaten to essentially intervene, to pre-invade Ukraine, to prevent an invasion, right? And this is over the Nord Stream pipeline. And we see Biden trying to push North American gas companies to kind of take the place of Russian gas with the Nord Stream pipeline. And I would say very much in the similar vein, the Obama administration saw, America and energy independence, which was his policy, as a way to essentially, wean the United States off of foreign oil imports. And it was under his administration that the United States became the first, for the first time in history since the 1970s, a net exporter of oil. And this coincided with the fracking revolution in 2008. And it was also a way that the Obama administration began to look at countries like Venezuela, and which has the world's largest oil reserves, and began to say, we don't actually like these counter or these alternatives to neoliberalism. And it was actually under Obama where we began to see the kind of heaviest and most deleterious sanctions against Venezuela. It was Trump implemented 213 during his administration, none of which Biden has repealed, but it was actually Obama's sanctions against Venezuela that actually set into motion what Trump later did during his administration. But what was fascinating about this particular moment in time is that his sanctions specifically targeted Venezuela's oil capacity and oil production capacity, because up until that point, the United States and the oil companies that were invested in Venezuela refused to kind of do technology transfers to allow Venezuela to refine its own oil. And a lot of it had been imported and sent to places like the Gulf of Mexico, where it's refined in places like Houston. And so the Obama administration began to target what it saw as like competitors, nations, and specifically not just oil competitors, but people who challenged U.S. hegemony within the global South, and specifically targeting Venezuela and Hugo Chavez, right? And for us as indigenous people, we were like, you know, I first heard about Chavez when he began his heating relief program for Northern Indian reservations. My reservation actually received heating assistance during a very cold winter. And that's where I first began to understand what the Bolivarian Revolution was. And so when, you know, Standing Rock popped off, a lot of us were, you know, talking about the creation of oil pipelines, domestic oil pipelines, within a geopolitical frame. And I don't think that really translated. A lot of people just think of us as like mystical, like people, like the Navi. We like to plug our braids into trees. We do a lot of praying, you know. That's kind of what gets the cameras, but I'm not going to do that today for you guys. I want to talk about the kind of anti-imperialist struggle and how we understand the geopolitics of oil production. So, you know, Obama canceled the Keystone XL pipeline, or at least the northern leg. He didn't cancel the southern leg, which was considered a domestic pipeline. It may have been transporting Canadian extracted or Canadian mined tar sands, but nonetheless, it was a domestic route. So President Obama approved 3/4 of the Keystone XL pipeline. He didn't kill the pipeline. He just killed the northern route, which crossed an international border, which fell outside his domestic oil policy or domestic energy production policy. The Dakota Access Pipeline actually fell within his domestic oil production policy. So it was something that he essentially approved. But as we saw it play out on the ground, there was this really great interview that kind of got, you know, ignored. The Democracy Now! Did with Winona LaDuke as she was like walking to the front line. And she said, the reason why, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline is being built is because the U.S. has, you know, essentially waged war on countries in the global South like Venezuela. And it might seem counterintuitive to think about sanctions against oil companies in the global South when we're talking about climate justice. But it's really how we understand, you know, even as people who consider themselves water protectors and have led, you know, one of the most historic fights against oil and gas in both Canada and the United States, we understand like development, we understand imperialism, and we understand especially that the way that global South nations develop is definitely curtailed by the policies of the global North. And it's also to understand that within the context of the Cochabamba Accords, or which were created in 2010 in Bolivia, that they actually made a similar argument, something that we had participated in, you know, as indigenous activists, climate activists in the North. You know, we understand like we have to move towards and transition towards sustainable development, but we also understand that the way that the levels of consumption in the global North, you know, are unfair in how they impact the global South. And so a country like Bolivia, a country like Venezuela will never have the per capita carbon emissions or be responsible for the kind of the emissions, you know, levels per capita of countries like the United States and Canada, nor do they have the same level of climate debt. And in fact, they would be considered nations that, you know, the United States and Canada owe climate debt to, right? Under the framework of the Cochabamba Accords.
Dedication to Sioux Tribe in Flint, Michigan.
They cracking for more oil, more environment, more water to spoil. You see they poisoning the people out there in Flint. Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, they facing imprisonment. All because they took a stand, water protectors against military tactics and tankers.
That was a clip from a song called Water Protectors by Public Enemy. We return now to Nick Estes.
So this is something that we really thought about in terms of drafting the Red Deal, which I think the DSA has passed as, you know, a working document in collaboration with something like the Green New Deal. This is just a kind of a brief overview. I don't have a whole lot of time to get into a lot of the inner workings of that. But I think in this moment in time, when we are talking about the transition away from fossil fuels, we have to remember the importance of water protectors and the role that they played. So indigenous people in the United States make up around 1%, 1.5% of the total population. And I think it's around 3% in Canada. They're more visible, or what's considered a more visible minority in Canada than they are in the States. But given their kind of small demographic size within both countries, indigenous-led movements in Canada and the United States, according to an Indigenous Environmental Network report that was issued last fall, we Indigenous-led movements are challenging a quarter of the carbon emissions from both Canada and the U.S. And so when we think about who are sort of the vanguards of the climate justice movement, it's not teenagers from Sweden, right? White teenagers from Europe who are actually the vanguards of these struggles, or those who get the kind of stage at COP26. It's actually land-based movements. And I think that's a really important kind of like factor that we have to consider, but also we have to understand that in this moment in time, the reality of transition is it's a pragmatic concern by both capital and social movements. But I think in this moment in time, we've also ceded a lot of ground on the left, or lost a lot of ground on the left, over the question of extractive capitalism itself, because extractive capitalism isn't something that's unique to the fossil fuel industry. But as we've seen with, you know, Biden's own Build Back Better plan, or promises to transition away from the fossil fuel economy, and, you know, promises of electrifying the federal fleet, we know that those kind of resources that go into so-called green renewable technologies, which I would, you know, I think many of us would argue are essential in a transition to a post-fossil fuel economy, have to come from somewhere. And simply, the technology doesn't exist right now to not have like things like pure copper ore that has to be extracted from the earth itself. It can't be recycled. That goes into, you know, renewable technologies like electric cars. So you have to create new copper mines. You have to create new lithium mines. You have to find these resources to continue and to maintain the levels of consumption in places like the United States. You know, we might have heard of things like Line 3 and support, you know, movements like Line 3 or movements against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And we should support, you know, those struggles and understand that the number of water protectors who were arrested at Line 3 actually far exceeds those who were arrested at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. We have to ask ourselves, why is it that one got more attention than the other one didn't? The same kind of resistance, is still the same. But also we have to ask ourselves why we don't know of movements such as the movement at Thacker Pass. I don't know if anyone has heard of this, but it's slotted to be one of the largest open pit lithium mines in Northern Nevada, which is being opposed by Shoshone and Paiute people, right? And so as we even as we move into kind of this green energy, you know, revolution or whatever, the kind of colonial extractive capitalism that defined the fossil fuel age is now defining the, you know, green revolution age. And there isn't a really, I think, a mature conversation about what that's going to look like for Indigenous people. Because it was under Obama and the National Defense Reauthorization Act that we got Resolution Copper, which, you know, set aside a Apache sacred site for Rio Tinto, which is an Australian mining company, to come in and create one of the world's largest copper mines, which will actually go about, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 feet below the surface, which will actually destroy the sacred landscape. And that's largely to meet, you know, America's projected energy needs, you know, that will be fed essentially by these green renewable technologies. And so that's really what, you know, at the heart of what we're talking about when we talk about the Red Deal. It's like we want to transition, but we want to just transition. That means, you know, that we move away not only from capitalism, but we also move away from the extractive colonial, you know, relationships that this government and these corporations have towards Native people. And what we learned in, you know, in the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle, as well as within the Line 3 struggle, that this is something that, you know, neither one of those struggles would have been possible nor successful to the degree that they were successful, even though they didn't stop the pipelines, had it not been for non-Indigenous allies. And so it's not just an Indigenous struggle, right? These are universal aspirations. Like, everyone drinks water, right? Anyone can become a water protector. It's just that these struggles are grounded in Indigenous values, as well as grounded in Indigenous leadership, and they're incredibly effective. And so I think in this era of, you know, global climate change, as well as an era where we are promoting alternatives, I think Indigenous people, whether you like it or not, are going to be at the forefront of this struggle. And it's how we work together in a way possible that, you know, is productive for understanding that this is a, you know, this is a land that we're going to have to share. It's not exclusively like Indigenous issues. They're everyone's issues. And so with that, I'll just open it up for questions because I'm out of time.
That was Dr. Nick Estes speaking about the importance of Indigenous resistance to colonial extractive capitalism. That's it for our show today. Thanks to Moles, Jen Hocken, and Larry Bolden, and to our guest, Hugh Gusterson. As always, we are grateful for the ongoing support and hard work of the KBOO staff. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. I'm going to leave you this morning with more from that song called What Have They Done by Squeeze. Catch us again next Monday morning, and until then, stay safe and stay active.